Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of August 26, 2024. So what do you got for us, Tom?
So the kickoff this week's, I have an article from Aon titled Unveiling SetXP, a Stealthy Linux Malware Exploiting UDEV Rules. So a little breakdown on this. So this is a stealthy new malware dubbed SetXP, and it utilizes UDEV rules to achieve persistence and evade detection. And while it has been active since 2022, it has been recently identified in multiple instances of online sandboxes undetected. So UDEV is a device management system for Linux kernel, for those that aren't aware, and it's responsible for managing nodes in the /dev directory. It does things like creates or removes device node files, handles like hot plug events to configure new devices, like a USB is an example, and it also loads drivers as necessary. UDEV rules are configuration files to match devices, execute actions, etc. By carefully manipulating the UDEV rules, the malware could execute alongside any given action in the configuration files that it was set up for. So, for instance, a configuration file for these UDEV rules is written to execute an action anytime a device is added to the system, configured to point to a specific directory within the /dev, and set to execute a malicious script when the UDEV rule is triggered. So an excerpt from the article itself. So quote, this rule ensures that the malware is run whenever /dev/random is loaded. /dev/random is a special file that serves as a random number generator used by various system processes and applications to obtain entropy for cryptographic operations, secure communications, and other functions requiring randomness. So the malware is loaded by the operating system on every reboot, meaning this rule would effectively ensure that the SetXP script is run upon system reboot. The malware includes a reverse shell and also modifies memory to hide any file containing the string SetXP from commands like is or find. And during research, they found this memory technique was used to conceal web shells, modify Apache configuration files, and the UDEV rules themselves as well. So the identified instances appeared to be financially motivated in nature, where the malware was used to hide code for credit card scraping on a web server. But yeah, I really found this one interesting, Scott. I tend to have a little bit of an ear towards things targeted at Linux. I'm curious, what were your thoughts on this when you read it?
So one of the things I love that was pointed out was, you know, kind of in the intro, they were saying this is a persistence technique that's not documented MITRE ATT&CK. And so I love the concept and what MITRE ATT&CK, like the whole matrix of all the techniques that are documented. But that's the thing. It is a list of things that have been seen. So either as adversaries get smarter with the technology we already use or new technologies emerge, that means there's going to be techniques that are kind of undocumented or not included in that MITRE ATT&CK matrix. So when people are like really stressing about getting the proper coverage of the MITRE ATT&CK matrix, it looks really good on paper to cover down on it everything if you can, but in instances where understanding attacks and what attackers are doing almost is almost a better method for actively defending your network, in my opinion. With having MITRE ATT&CK is a great way to, you know, visualize or, you know, create priorities or understanding of what you actually have. The other thing that I loved is I didn't know about the whole UDEV functionality. And this is what I think is really cool when it comes to, I think I've touched on it before, but threat hunters, what makes threat hunters unique as far as a resource to a security operation is with something like this, they're not going to just focus on, oh, okay, so I just, anytime I see this, you know, command line run, let's make a detection, let's alert on this. It's like, as a threat hunter, I see this and I'm going to be like, well, what is this UDEV thing? How else can this be utilized? Like, how does that actually work? And so, you know, naturally I start getting this better understanding of these mechanisms. And obviously if I have Linux in my environment, then understanding, well, where are things possibly exposed? And, you know, how could this be leveraged even in my, because they also talked about different outcomes, right? Using this technique, like modifying Apache files versus running reverse shells. So it's very clear the adversaries that are using this technique, it's not just like a built-in copy and paste thing from a malware that you just see generically run every single time just to have successful execution. There's intention behind everything being done based on the environments they're in, based on what they're trying to achieve and all that kind of stuff. So there's that I also find very fascinating. And then what's interesting is I was just kind of curious about the command line, because it talks about the config for this rule. You know, it mentions a major number and a minor number, right? And the major number really associates with any common devices associated with major number one are like the memory, the kernel memory, a null device, a zero device, all those things included. But then eight really associates with the dev random. Like that's what pulls that in. No, I'm sorry. One associates with the dev. Eight associates with the random number generator. But all the other minor numbers that can be included, there are other areas. So you can understand how other ways you kind of trigger things or make things not triggers often. So it's just kind of interesting there. So I thought it was a really cool capability. Hats off to the folks that are figuring this out and using it, but also, you know, it just goes to show that there's very, there's multiple ways that execute things within the operating systems themselves, both Windows and Linux, and understanding what those are kind of gives you an edge when it comes to, you know, thinking ahead of the attackers.
Yeah, and thanks for spiking that alley-oop there on with the MITRE attack framework. That was one of the parts that really stood out to me. People tend to, I think it becomes like don't get lost in the buzzword, right? So MITRE attack is great. It's a really cool framework. It's a great place to build from or leverage against, but it's not an end all be all, because things will happen that they're not tracking. Like nobody should be looking at as the one person to hold all the answers. And then, it was really interesting across the board. I was familiar with UDEV a bit, but not in a way that I ever would have thought about it as being an exploitation area, right? A place to exploit. So this was really cool. Recommend everyone check it out, dig into this methodology a little more. I know I'm going to be, what do you got for us, Scott?
So I'm going to jump into, one of the Mandy at Google reports. It's called Peaklight, Decoding the Stealthy Memory Only Malware. This was interesting because, similar to what we were talking about before, like unique ways to execute, they kind of are leaning towards that same way. Like, oh, look at these cool things they can do. But it's really about a new memory only dropper, and they call it using a complex multi-stage infection process. So already you almost kind of like get that feeling like, oh, great. Now what are they doing that I can't detect? Well, you know, to understand the full attack and basic summary, it's really just an LNK file that launches PowerShell that's launching MSHTA, dropping something in app data roaming, which is then also launching PowerShell, which is now downloading Peaklight. And so like right off the rip, you're like, well, it kind of sounds similar to things I've seen at least, right? Where when you have PowerShell launching MSHTA, I mean, that's not a normal process. When you have LNKs launching PowerShell, like that whole chain, so it opens a shortcut. I mean, that's kind of been happening for a while. It's interesting that the chain is very complex, but the techniques are still kind of the same simple techniques that a lot of attackers build on. The one thing, though, that stood out to me that I haven't really seen before, but it exists, but not this way typically, or commonly, I should say, it is the use of four files, which is basically an ability. It's an executable on Windows that allows you to basically look in directories for files and then do something with it, right? It's usually included a lot in like bash scripts to like, you know, crawl a directory, do certain actions, whatever it is. And in this case, They're using four files to execute PowerShell, which is then going to call that MSHT I was talking about. And how they do it is the parameter they're passing is they're looking in the Windows directory, and if they ever match the win.ini file saying if this file exists, then execute PowerShell, blah, 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 right? So it's like an interesting way of execution yet again. Like we touched that the first thing you talked about, and now this time it's another interesting way for execution. And the thing about the win.ini file, I think that file has existed back in like Windows like 3.0 or whatever it was. Like it's just a persistent file you expect to see on Windows systems in general. So it's just something that I guess an attacker can rely on to utilize this mechanism to execute things. And then, you know, there's other, as you work your way down on some of the other techniques that actually happen within this malware, as they mentioned, initiates, you know, a stealthy PowerShell launch, which is something we've commonly seen too, right? Where you're running like the hidden window argument. The only thing that's interesting here is when you pass arguments to PowerShell. So in this case, you're using the dash W for window, right? So they're shortening already the argument, but even the arguments themselves, you don't have to call them by name. You can call them by position, right? And so they're passing the number one, which is, you know, tied to the position of the hidden argument for that window command. So that's always interesting to look for, or something unique to kind of get around a lot of detections. Because a lot of times when you look at detections, right, you're assuming they're going to use the words for the things, but there's other ways that us as threat hunters need to be thinking about is how can this technique be used in many ways, but still be doing the exact same thing? Because a lot of times, like we say, techniques get reused, but they just might look different. That's a good case of that. And then, like I said, the typical PowerShell launch also doing the execution bypass, you know, unrestricted, also very common, and also skips loading user profiles with the NOP arguments. So they you know, talked about using covert operations with that, but it's like, that's nothing new, right? When we're looking at these types of attacks, like the techniques I highlighted here are things we've been looking at as parts of other attacks. Now they haven't been used in this complex chain together necessarily, right? But that's what's really interesting is, okay, so we see these techniques from a while ago, and instead of coming up with new techniques, it's just what different combinations of techniques do you use together to make these new attacks essentially? And sometimes maybe using them in a certain combination helps hide what detections will be looking for that technique, because it's run in a slightly different way, or what executes or leads to it's slightly different. I think that's what some of the drivers for these chaining, right, for these types of attacks. So, yeah, I mean, as far as, you know, what PeakLight is, you know, it's just a PowerShell-based downloader, so I'm sure it can lead to a bunch of other things they want to be pulled down on the system. I didn't really get into a lot of those specifics because really just wanted to focus on, from my perspective, on is this really unique, and what is it they're doing to really execute things that is being called out as unique. So yeah, that's kind of my big takeaway from this. I was curious what you kind of thought when you saw this, or what stood out to you.
Yeah, I mean, echoing some of the stuff you had already said, I mean, even in the article itself, it talks about, and you focus on the four files, but there's breakdowns of actually three different variations of this. And in the other variations, nothing necessarily stood out on first pass as being something really net new. But you did see, like you were mentioning, the combination of how they were trying to attempt to do the thing, even though it was all the same, you know, the same goal, or maybe just tweaked for different targets or a slightly different goal. But it's worth echoing harder that, you know, looking for these things, even when they seem kind of like, yeah, we covered down them. So I'm thinking about it from like an analyst perspective. I'm like wanting to protect my environment or start threat on them in my environment. You say, shout out a threat actor like PeakLight. And it's like, oh yeah, we covered down on those things. You know, we've seen this thing, we're good, we're covered there. But this little tiny nugget, like that four files mentioned, it's like, okay, well, we don't cover that. So maybe that might be, depending on how everything's kind of compiled or laid out, that one little miss might be the thing that lets it actually detonate in your environment. So that was a great point. I mean, I'm going to leave it there, Scott. But yeah.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, and like I said, it's always fun to see what is starkingly that new, and then kind of going back on at least what we know from experience and seeing, you know, how new is it really, right? So It's always interesting to do that. So what do you have next on the docket?
All right. So my second article for this week from Checkpoint Research titled Unmasking Stick Stealer, How Hijackers Slip Led to an Intelligence Treasure Trove. So there was a lot of depth for this one for me. So bear with me a little bit. Feel free to jump in if you feel anything's really hot there to jump on the topic there, Scott, because there's a lot of different details in here. But I'm going to kind of give a rundown here. So the stick stealer, it's a malware capable of stealing saved passwords, cookies, autofill data from Chromium and Gecko-based browsers, data from extensions, crypto wallets, as well as Telegram and Discord sessions. So Checkpoint Research believes this stealer is based on an older version of the FEMA drone stealer, which lacks certain features of the newer version. So the stick stealer was built on one. It seems like the threat actor only had access to an older version of this and tried to build on top of it. Stick stealer, however, added some new features like auto start, clipboard monitoring. This one I found interesting. I'm always interested by that one. Sandbox evasion, anti-analysis techniques, just to name a couple. So the stealer is subscription-based. The articles spoke on it starting around $75 a month and carried demos of the tool on YouTube, but they've since been taken down. So how it was found. In March of 2024, Checkpoint Research identified a spam campaign attempting to distribute malicious tar files, which contained Agent Tesla Steal. Man, the Steelers, there's so many. I'm losing
track.
Yeah. Even in reading this article. In this campaign, Agent Tesla used the Telegram bot API for Exfil, and this allowed Checkpoint to extract the Telegram bot token from the malware config. So as they were kind of doing more analysis, they uncovered a user that was based out of Nigeria. It was associated with this token, and the campaign was primarily targeting Chinese companies, but also some in India, the UAE, and the Philippines. And while they monitored the bot activity, they actually uncovered an archive that was not like the typical Agent Tesla archive. And as they dove into that, they identified the stick stealer. So in the stick stealer archive, there were screenshots and information showing like hard-coded Telegram bot tokens and chat IDs. And that allowed Checkpoint to further identify the creator of the stick stealer. And they did identify that this person was Turkish-based based on a few parameters that they uncovered, including telephone records and connectivity to the bot, things like that. So this led to the discovery of that user, of the Turkish user, we'll call him, collaborating with the individual out of Nigeria to help kind of build the stick stealer further. So the user out of Nigeria had the idea in the communications that we're seeing in these archives back and forth that adding Telegram bot API for Exfil would be a good thing. So in the communications here, for a couple different reasons, they went unencrypted because of the use of the bot, also of the use of the older version of the FEMA drone stealer. And the creator of the stick stealer revealed all kinds of fun information, personal details, Telegram accounts being used, emails, contacts, all kinds of stuff. So a slip up was in the communication, not being encrypted really, is kind of what we've really seen. But yeah, this was really interesting to me. There is a whole lot of depth here. A quick nugget too, like one of the things I brought up, like clipboard activity. So on Windows, clipboard activity isn't really logged by default. And I don't think it's on by default on most security solutions like EDRs, but I know the capability does exist. So there are logging things that can be enabled, rules that can be enabled to track these things. And you need to take a look for the logs of these tools that capture processes accessing the clipboard, which indicates suspicious behavior. So this is something like I thought. I see clipboard and I always think it's a good nugget to go search things. I don't know that most people would necessarily consider it, build detections around it, or maybe think out of bat to go hunt for it. But to me, it always seems like one of those things that I like to keep in my tool set as something to tag. But I'll take a breath, Scott. What do you think? What do you think about this article?
Yeah, so first I'll start with like the easy dig, which was the persistence thing that was mentioned, run registry key, right? You know, I love that, you know, I would put, and like we've talked about in the past, like info stealers are kind of like a low bar malware, right? Or treated that way. Now there's, I think, greater risk, and we've talked about that as well. But because it's kind of one of these like, hey, just needs to get in there, run of the mill, steal some things and get out, or, you know, maybe stay persistent if it can. The persistence mechanisms are never really super sophisticated. And a lot of them, what we've seen, especially, and we're seeing it here, is there is the run key persistence, The other thing that kind of strikes me now that we've seen so many info stealers in general, and they kind of showed in the article, right? They have the whole like info stealer as a service, like dashboard, right? Like you can pay for this, you can pay for this, pay for this. And then also like the whole GUI builder to make it super simple to where you can like add capabilities when you compile your stuff or take capabilities out. It pretty much just sounds like it's getting traction and kind of mirroring what you see for ransomware as a service, right? And I feel like ransomware as a service really matured that whole model for how do we enable, you know, people and you make money off, you know, people doing the work for us, as we can just build a great platform, great way to share, great way to help in that capacity. And, you know, we've seen it with, you know, phishing. It hasn't been as sticky with the phishing as a service, I don't think. Maybe it's just, yeah, those don't really get tied to big breaches yet. But I feel like, you know, info stealing is going to be similar to ransomware as a service, as big as that has gotten. If it's not already at that size, because, you know, we hear about it, but I haven't been like looking at how is it being distributed and shared out in this capacity. So that stood out as well, just because it smells very similar, right, to what we've been seeing from that front. And ransomware has definitely gained traction as it matured to that model over the past probably 5-6 years.
Highlight Steelers spoil the big business model too. Yeah.
And to be honest, like the big business model kind of makes sense, just because it's really about how do we just optimize, you know, collecting data and sharing it to whoever wants to buy it. So there's the whole back end. That's the one thing, is if you're not looking to use the data right away, you still got to look at it like you need a mule or some avenue to, you know, sell the data you have. And that's the other part of this marketplace as a service that I think is probably going to mature if it kind of goes more to this route, as like, okay, so I use this now, what other markets do I plug into for selling some of this stuff, or, you know, doing advertising what I have? Because it's not really about doxing, because at that point, if you tell people that you stole the credentials for things, it's just they can change them, right? So it's not like ransomware where you're like, we have all this data and it's all public. Info stealers, it's not very public, so it's going to be kind of a different model from that front. So
yep. Yeah, what do you got for us, Scott?
Well, always something that's a big brain exhaustive report, but it's the deeper report, to try to say it, you know, lightly. So they put a report out, it was today, right? And it's, you know, they just basically called it black suit ransomware, which has been covered before, right? But the biggest thing is they're just walking through a full breach. And so if you're not familiar with DFU reports, it's really, really good reporting that covers usually start to finish from a like full intrusion of all the actions and all the data associated with looking at all the actions that were being had during a breach or compromise. And this is one that happened in December 2023 that they're pushing out there. But it started with execution of Cobalt Strike beacons and then with the deployment of Black Suit ransomware. They leveraged various tools between SharpHound, Rubius, SystemBC, Get Data Info, PowerShell Scripts, Cobalt Strike, ADFine, and then also Lay of the Land stuff. A lot of the command and control traffic was actually proxied through Cloudflare. So, you know, very hard to potentially, you know, block that outright because Cloudflare is kind of a provider of many things. But the other thing to keep in mind is it was a 15 days of after initial access that the ransomware was deployed. So there was at least 2 weeks, if you're looking for these types of things that we'll, you know, briefly mention here, you might be able to get ahead of something like this. So they kind of run through kind of the breakout of things that stood out to me. One was services being installed. So when we look at a lot of attacks, there are really two places that persistence and execution kind of spawn from together. And it's either, like we mentioned earlier, registry run keys or services being installed. The thing about the services being installed is a lot of times you really do best monitoring the event ID 7045. Because it has the details that really do stand out, in my opinion, as far as like, well, where is the service being, like, what's the folder path of the executable or whatever's being there. And then, you know, and in this case, it's being installed from the admin share, which is not normally a common place. When you see a path of admin dollar sign, it's basically like an open share on your computer that people are then dropping. They can drop things remotely. And if they can execute anything remotely, they can make a service spin up. And sometimes that's how COBOL strike beacons are, you know, transferred laterally and executed. And they also have another services where they're running CommSpec, PowerShell execution, which is kind of a way to do lateral execution as well. So, you know, two things that just stood out right away. If you have, you know, the 745 event ID, really easy to see, and those are not normal executions in general. They also still leverage registry run keys. So something to take note, why I think persistence and execution are like the two favorite things for me to look at, is persistence usually, especially if it's got to be a fast campaign when they look at ransomware and like how quick they have to turn around. There's usually multiple persistence mechanisms that are installed in case one fails or they get kicked out. They can get right back in and try to finish what they're doing. So I think it's really interesting to always look for those things in general, because there might be the easy one. Like if you find the registry run key that stands out odd, well, it's probably pointing to the same hour that the service is running, you know, potentially, right? So like now you have at least two avenues that point to the same thing. They can then kick off all your responses that may hopefully, you know, kick them out, remove everything. Typically, like another, I wouldn't say point of persistence necessarily, but it could enable a point of persistence if not lateral movement is enabling RDP. We see this all the time, but basically what they're doing is they're changing the registry key value of denied TS connections to false. So instead of, you know, if you make double negative false and deny, it means true TS connections are allowed. So that's kind of one of the things they're doing to enable RDP that you can easily see. But one thing I really liked in here in the data they shared was a really good example of Kerber roasting. They showed really good data as far as like dropping the encryption, doing the log on, but it's the zero value. It basically says you don't have to auth before logging in. So it's the precursor. So it's like the pre-authentication type. That's what I'm looking for. And then obviously from the service name itself, you can see the KRB TGT that is being run. So you see a lot of these, right, happening. And you have 4768 event codes or event IDs. That's how you kind of know Kerber roasting is actually occurring. Something that I thought was really good as far as how they walked through that and also showed the data. And then, you know, they did a lot of process injection for where they're running these tools. So when they looked at file creates, they had some weird file creates, you know, creating TXT files from executables that usually don't create those kind of files. And that's something else to kind of call out. Like, if you know there's lull bins, for instance, that typically do not create files when run, and you have one that they're creating files to begin with, you know, and you can create that, or anything usually creating a TXT, unless it's like an error log or something like that, which usually will create its own thing and probably a dot log or something like that. But TXTs, look at a lot of the ransomware groups and what they're doing. When they drop information from anything they discover, a lot of times it falls into a TXT, and we think, yeah, text files are, you know, they're not something that's like a great thing to say, oh, something bad has happened, because they can happen in general. But when system files are doing that, that typically don't do that, or you're seeing a lot of TXT files from the same executable, I don't know. Sometimes it's like that might be worth looking at, because you might uncover some of that stuff, even, you know, seeing later in here. So that's something else. You know, they even talked about it, right, when it comes to SharpHound. So if you're not familiar with Bloodhound, Bloodhound is a tool that lets you map AD environments and also potentially show attack paths based on privileged access. So if you get this account, this is how far you can go with it. This is where you can maybe pivot to other accounts, that kind of thing. And SharpHound is one of the things used to generate the files or the data from Active Directory, then drop into your Bloodhound instance, because Bloodhound doesn't have to actually exist in the environment you're attacking. Something you have that you just need to get SharpHound to collect those files for. Well, they, you know, obviously they're having some detections based on the typical files that are created, because they're JSON files and zip files, but they have a specific naming convention. that, you know, you pull those across. So another interesting thing looking at specific file generations, when you know how tools work or attack tools work, a lot of people don't change that. And sometimes it's harder to change than you think. So they just run them natively and that'd be easy detections. Something else that happens with the scanning when it comes to Bloodhound, is there's a Windows event 5145, and I've talked about it before and I forgot the context, of the article, if it was a full on breach or just using shares, but basically it's the Windows event that looks at network file share activity in general. And what's great about it is on a system that's not a, file share, and you have this logging enabled because it has to be enabled, it's off by default, you won't really get much noise unless someone actually spins up a share or is trying to do some things with a share. So the amount of volume you really get from this on a non-share system is, I wouldn't say next to nothing, but very few. Versus if it is a share, you probably want to be auditing that anyways, but expect a larger load, obviously, because that's the intention. But in this case, with SharpHound doing all the, you know, level of investigations across the AD environment access, it hits the IPC dollar sign, which is another kind of open share for communication. So it was hitting across a lot of the systems laterally. And so that activity is kind of being seen from the 5145 log, which I also thought was interesting. So when you talk about people jumping on your admin shares or the IPC shares, which aren't common shares utilized all the time, but attackers seem to use them, that'd be another way to detect some activity you're not really thinking about. And then, you know, typical lulbin directory discovery stuff, or, you know, Windows discovery stuff, which is like the net, you know, NL test, ping, route, system info, stuff like that. We see a lot of that stuff happening within the same time window. It's suspicious. And then obviously, because they were injected into other processes, seeing that stuff executing from non-standard places is also a good sign of there's not something good going on. And then past the hash stuff. So if you're seeing they did leverage some past the hash, which I think is interesting that, you know, that goes on as much as it still does. But basically you're looking where if you have SEC logo and event type 9 in the same authentication, then it's likely past the hash. So those are events worth looking at as well. So, and then that was really just, I mean, I'm really only covered like the first half. I know the second half goes into more IOCs and more, how certain things actually work, but just in the first half, I was able to, you know, pull out all that information and understand a lot about the attack. And also, you know, that's the more important stuff to me. When we talk about the later stuff, when it's the actual ransomware kicking off and running, you know, I want to get ahead of that. So I list off a number of things where you just start discovering one or two of those. Probably within 24 hours, you'll know what's going on. And that's still quick enough to stop the whole ransomware attack that happened 15 days later. So that's kind of why I focus more on that as well. But yeah, so after that, just giant, like I said, there's these reports are very rich. What was your take, Tom?
Yeah, it was really dense, but not in a bad way. It just, there's a lot there. So yeah, you know, one of the things, just kind of going back, you know, I thought there was an interesting little nugget there where they talked about how the threat actor would leverage traffic proxy through Cloudflare, but then they would pivot mid attack to AWS. So that was kind of interesting to me.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why I don't one and two passes in a very dense report. I may have skipped over. I don't think I did, but I had some thoughts on why that might be the thing, maybe for tooling or for access or maybe for just to kind of shroud their activity. But no, I mean, it was so full of a lot of different threat hunting things. And when you think about that time frame where they said it's like 15 days it took them, right, to go through the process of the whole attack, it's like, man, there's a lot of things there that could help protect an environment. You know right away that something was going down. You mentioned a bunch of them. So a couple of the really loose ones on the top, you know, MSTSC as a child process from a suspicious parent. I know you kind of gave a general of like, you know, the lulbin's being executed from somewhere suspicious. The use of AdFind, I can't imagine that's going to be heavily done in environments, right? So that's a really simple dig point to gather data to start fishing through, hunting through, or even building a detection, depending on how noisy your environment.
They don't even read data half the time when they use it, you know?
They just use it, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was another one, and I wonder if you'll riff with me on this a little bit, because I had a thought on this one. So when they talked about the use of, or when they would their assessment of the get-data-info.ps1 script, so part of the payload. So it showed in there when they discussed that the threat actor actually had a bit of a slip up. So when they loaded that PowerShell script, they didn't consider a specific parameter and it forced PowerShell into default mode. So when they were trying to execute certain commands, they were failing and they stopped after so many. And then they came back later, like the next day, and then were able to successfully launch it when they figured out what was wrong with there. But there was a little tiny nugget in there where they were looking to execute these commands like an add find, things like that, inside of this process because it was hands-on keyboard based on the way they were doing it. And in my mind, I was thinking, you know, I never thought before about, you know, rare commands from an administration point and how many, you know, thinking about maybe number of failures within a time frame, you know, suspicious attempts, like multiple attempts in these kind of modes. It was a very loose thought, but it had my brain starting to really turn on this. Like, maybe that's an avenue. It's a little more roundabout, but I'm thinking about that. I'm like, you know, what other things inside of the stuff that we look in day to day could we consider in that notion? Like this one, in my mind, I want to dig into more. Like, I wonder if there's weight there, you know, like, okay, this could I have caught the attacker in this process failing a bunch of times and then stopping suddenly? Like, would that stand out in an environment? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, what's interesting about PowerShell, and I'm probably not going to remember all the specifics about this when I went through like a whole course on it, but, and I don't know if it's just associated with profiles or there's other ways, I believe there's other ways to lock it down even more. But essentially, you can actually, based on group policy and some configurations, set up where only certain people can actually run certain commands. And it could be, and the rules for that could even be like, anyone can run git, you know, dash star. So any git command, anyone can run, right? But then you can like have other type of commands limited. And what's interesting is like, we know what commands, attackers like to run, right? And the thing is, even if you use aliases at that point, I believe those like filters or rules still apply. But I think when you actually set that up, then you'll catch errors or violations, like you mentioned, that it might actually enable you to say, hey, if we have a lot of violations for these types of things on these systems, like especially all these things that we restricted specifically for this reason, that might be a really good way to look at it. Now, I hate that I can't give you all the specifics other than the fact that I know it exists and I know there's some capability there. Obviously, there's some care and feeding. It's almost like, well, you know, application whitelisting is great, but that takes some work. True, but they're just doing a little bit of it goes a long way, right? Like you don't have to have it perfect. You don't have to have this huge, crazy deployment, but you can say, maybe by just turning this on, we get better visibility of just what actions are being had, you know, in that avenue versus, you know, just restricting things. I don't know. But so that's something else that I've never really thought all the way through until you just brought that up. But it's something worth looking at. And maybe it'd be great if some people, you know, when we share this kind of stuff out, people will respond with, oh, this is how you do it. And this is what I've done. And it works really well. And here's an example. Like, perfect. Now where the community is getting better. But yeah, that's what it makes me think of.
No, yeah, good point. Yeah, I mean, I would love to hear it from a big brain because it's interesting. It's a very interesting idea.
Yeah, so good report. Like I said, we always get asked the question, like, what do I do if I'm getting started in threat hunting or started whatever? I always point to a lot of our resources that we have, you know, in the cyber resources domain for some of our free stuff. But also, I like to always call it deeper reports because they're so rich that it kind of gives you a lot of exposure to the different things that you may at least need to understand. So you can branch out from there much easier to cover down on all the right things. Because there's a lot of places you can spend your wheels in cybersecurity and maybe not get the same return you're looking for. So yeah, I always like to reference them. So I would say with that, kind of closes out our weekly digest here. So I just want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Look forward to syncing up next week. And that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of August 26, 2024. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, Check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.